The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, April 15th, 2024. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. In tonight's news,
Madison teachers are rallying against a proposed wage freeze for this coming year.
The state capitol is getting a new history-making statue this summer.
And in the second half, a conversation with a Madison-based zine editor who's up for a prestigious award, a retrospective on the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, a closer look at a popular cocktail, and two movie reviews.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we'll go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
I'm Stuart McIntosh with the BBC News. Hello. Donald Trump has marked the end of the first day of a landmark trial against him in New York by telling reporters it's a scam and a political witch hunt. Mr. Trump was speaking after becoming the first ever US president to face criminal charges in court. He denies trying to disguise a hush money payment to an adult film star in 2016. As Neda Taufik reports, the main activity in the court today was in jury selection.
More than half of those potential jurors said they could not be impartial. And after that, we then went into a situation where those jurors were individually questioned. The judge said this was one of the most extensive jury questionnaires they've ever had in this court, looking at what kind of news they consume, if they're a part of any extremist groups, if they ever attended a Trump rally. So that will continue, Sumi, tomorrow and for the next few days until they get 12 jurors and 6 alternates who can be impartial in this case.
The French president, Emmanuel Macron, says donors have pledged more than $2 billion in aid for Sudan at a conference on the first anniversary of the conflict there. The fighting between rival military factions has displaced 8 million people. Mr. Macron said almost half the pledges had come from EU countries.
Aujourd'hui, d'importants moyens ont été mobilisés grâce à vous.
Today, significant resources have been mobilized thanks to you, and in total we can announce that more than 2 billion euros will be mobilized for the women and men of Sudan. Before this conference, we had a commitment of 190 million euros. This evening, we're at 2 billion euros for Sudan.
Israel's war cabinet has met for a second time in as many days to discuss its response to Iran's unprecedented drone and missile attack. Earlier, the head of Israel's army reiterated that the attack would be met with a response. The lower house of parliament in Britain, the House of Commons, has rejected 6 amendments to a controversial new bill which aims to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda. The bill will now return to the upper chamber, the House of Lords. Ian Watson reports.
The Rwanda policy is 2 years old this month, but so far no refugee has been sent there. The Prime Minister is hopeful that when his legislation declaring Rwanda to be a safe country is passed, flights will finally get off the ground. The government moved a step closer to this tonight when the Commons saw off attempts by the Lords to make changes, including an amendment that would have prevented refugees who had supported the UK armed forces overseas from being removed to Rwanda. The government rejected calls to exempt victims of modern slavery from the Rwanda scheme, but passed its own amendment to provide an annual report on that policy's impact.
This is the latest world news from the BBC. The weapons supervisor who loaded the gun that killed a cinematographer on the set of the film Rust has been sentenced to 18 months in prison. Ana Gutierrez-Reed was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in March. The actor Alec Baldwin was holding the gun when it fired and killed Halina Hutchins during rehearsals in New Mexico in 2021. The head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, has warned that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station in Ukraine is on the verge of a serious accident. Rafael Grossi was speaking after the reactor building was hit in a drone attack on Sunday, the worst such incident since November 2022. The US State Department has said it'll only renew Venezuela's oil sector licenses if there's progress on its commitment to hold free and fair elections in July. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, has more.
US sanctions against Venezuela's socialist government began about a decade ago over alleged human rights violations. They were tightened after President Nicolás Maduro was controversially re-elected in 2018, following the arrest or ban of his main opponents. 6 months ago, Mr. Maduro signed a deal with the opposition, promising to open up the electoral process. The U.S. agreed in return to issue new oil and gas licenses, which expire this week. But the main opposition candidate, Maria Corina Machado, has since been banned from running against Mr. Maduro, who's seeking a third term in office. Her first chosen replacement wasn't able to register.
Creating fake sexually explicit material of someone without their consent is set to become a criminal offence in parts of Britain. While UK laws already criminalise sharing such digital content, individuals in England and Wales who produce so-called deep fakes without the subject's consent will soon face an unlimited fine, regardless of whether they intend to distribute the images. BBC News.
This is Rachel Fields and Sam Swartz with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
The Wisconsin Election Commission has confirmed that its administrator, Megan Wolf, has received additional security, an unusual measure for election officials, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Wolf has come under fire from Republicans for her role in confirming that President Biden won Wisconsin in 2020, including an attempt by Republican legislators to oust her from her role in 2023, which was of dubious legality. Wolf has also been on the receiving end of a number of disparaging comments from former President Trump, including last week when Trump suggested she would try and steal the upcoming election and should not be allowed to serve. The details of the security measures to protect Wolf have not been released. In a statement, Wolf emphasized that she intended to oversee the upcoming election in a nonpartisan role.
United States Senator candidate Eric Hovde announced that his campaign had raised $9.1 million in the first quarter of 2024 in a filing with the Federal Election Commission. The majority of that money came in the form of a loan that Hovde had made to his own campaign, amounting to $8 million of his own dollars, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So far, Hovde has spent more than $3 million, leaving him with a little over $5 million to spend in his attempt to unseat Senator Tammy Baldwin. For her part, Baldwin has raised more than $5 million in the first quarter of this year, with about $10 million in the bank.
Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business lobby, has filed a petition with the Wisconsin Supreme Court asking them to strike down a partial veto that Governor Evers made in crafting the state budget, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The original budget, passed by the Republican-controlled legislature, said that public schools can raise the amount of money they raise per student by $325 for the 2024 to 2025 school year. Evers used his partial veto powers to remove the 20 and the hyphen, rewriting the budget so it said the year 24-25. That extended funding increases for schools for the next 400 years. Wisconsin is one of a few states where a governor has a partial veto power, and the governor's veto power has already been curtailed. Previously, the courts struck down Wisconsin's Vanna White veto, which used to allow governors to stitch together sentences or take out single letters. The Supreme Court may decide to take up the lawsuit directly or allow it to work its way through the lower courts.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court will hear arguments this week on a case that is challenging the practice of committee vetoes in the Wisconsin legislature, reports Wisconsin Watch. The case, which was brought by Governor Tony Evers, claims that the way the committees in the Wisconsin legislature reject executive branch policies without passing new laws violates the Wisconsin Constitution. Currently, powerful committees in the legislature can unilaterally strike down rules created by Wisconsin agencies, as when the Joint Finance Committee blocked conservation projects undertaken by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, or when the Joint Committee on Employment Relations held up pay raises for public employees. Wisconsin is one of the few states that allow committee vetoes, and legal challenges to the practice in other states have mostly been successful.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is encouraging the public to avoid all outdoor burning due to elevated fire risks across the state, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The DNR reports that the state had almost 40 fires on Saturday, making it the most active wildfire day in Wisconsin thus far. This year. The DNR has also encouraged Wisconsinites to be careful when operating off-road vehicles and other large equipment, as they can create sparks and start fires by accident.
Madison's Common Council is considering a resolution tomorrow that would establish pathways and options for forming the city's 2025 budget. The resolution calls for a referendum in the November election that would ask voters to increase taxes so that the city can address its funding deficit. It also affirms the council's desire to maintain current levels of public services and called on city staff to prepare contingency plans in case voters reject the tax increase this fall.
Meanwhile, also at tomorrow's council meeting, a resolution that affirms the city's support for survivors of domestic violence and abuse. According to that resolution, 96 people were killed in domestic partner homicides across Wisconsin in 2022. In that same year, Madison police spent upwards of 13,000 hours on domestic disturbance calls. 16 of the city's 20 alders have sponsored the legislation as of our last check before broadcast. That includes one alder recently under fire after two former partners came forward with allegations of domestic abuse. Alder Charlie Miades is publicly denied that the allegations and claimed his support for domestic abuse services like Safe Harbor, which told Madison 365 in a subsequent statement that Miades did not deliver on any action to benefit the organization and did not respond to their request for assistance. That's as some alders have heard calls from their constituents to remove Miades from office, but under state law, alders can only be removed by their peers after a finding of cause, which must be related to an alder's positions or actions while they are in office. It would not extend to allegations prior to an alder's term.
Spartan Nash, a Michigan-based grocery wholesaler and retailer, announced its purchase of Metcalf's Market, which has two stores in Madison, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The company's current management team is staying on and has emphasized that this purchase will help them expand and provide more product lines and will not include any employee turnover or rebranding. They say the purchase will also not affect Bratfest, which Metcalf's usually puts on in May. And those were the headlines. Now on to the rest of today's top stories.
The Madison School Board is grappling with a projected multi-million dollar budget deficit for next year. As Madison schools get squeezed by inflationary pressures and more, they're also facing advocacy from their workers, as Madison teachers continue to advocate for wage increases. WORT News producer Faye Parks has the story.
Madison schools are facing a nearly $12.5 million deficit next year, as the district grapples with issues like inflation and the expiration of pandemic relief money, and as the school board is slated to take up next year's budget at a meeting tonight. The teachers' union is inviting educators to rally outside the Doyle Administration Building. That's as an opening salvo from MMSD had the school district initially propose a 0% raise for teachers several weeks ago. MTI President Michael Jones says teachers deserve to be one of the district's highest budget priorities.
The district's initial offer of a 0% cost of living adjustment essentially means that staff are going to take a 4% pay cut in terms of not being able to keep up with inflation. And that is going to be a significant impact on how schools are staffed going into next year.
Jones says Madison educators are likely to search for other work if they don't get competitive wages.
So then what happens is you have less staff who have to pick up those responsibilities, which increases stress and increases burnout, which means more people leave even those positions because they're doing the work of sometimes three or four or five people.
According to a recent community survey conducted by the district, nearly 80% of respondents said they would approve a referendum in November asking for more operating funds. But Jones says that the district can't afford to wait for voter approval before raising teacher wages because high turnover is pricier.
It actually costs the district and the taxpayers more money to replace a worker who's already there than to try to recruit, train, get them up to speed, the new person, and make sure that they're not feeling overwhelmed when they have to do all those additional duties.
Last year, the school board approved a historic 8% cost of living wage hike. That came after extreme pressure from the union, Madison teachers, and families. Jones says that the budget was evidence that the school board empathizes with teachers and that prioritizing staff benefits the district as a whole.
You know, I can't speak for them, but I think they felt like we were worth the investment last year so that you wouldn't see more turnover going into this latest school year, which happened. Turnover went down, like we lost fewer folks because they were compensated fairly.
Jones says he doesn't blame Madison School Board for the systemic lack of education funding.
This is a system that's been intentionally targeted for decades to be underfunded, underutilized, disrespected, and mismanaged. That is on all of us, so we all need to be more vigilant and demand more of the legislature and in the governor's office and in other spaces.
MMSD is expected to have a final budget draft in June. The school board meets tonight at 6 p.m. in person and virtually via YouTube. Also on the agenda is an agreement with the Verona School District over 4K services, reviews of MMSD's ambitious sustainability goals, the naming process for the district's newest elementary school, reviews of policies on student fees and graduation requirements, and more. The MTI protest outside the Doyle Administration Building was slated to start shortly before this show, around 5 or 5:30. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
Clean water advocates are cheering new drinking water standards announced by the Environmental Protection Agency and tied to so-called forever chemicals. The action coincides with ongoing efforts and debates at the state level to address PFAS. Mike Moen of the Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
Efforts to limit human exposure to so-called forever chemicals continue to unfold in Wisconsin. Meanwhile, advocates are hopeful residents will be protected by a new national drinking water standard. On Wednesday, the EPA unveiled a final rule that for the first time sets a legally enforceable drinking water benchmark for PFAS chemicals all states will have to follow. Scientists have been highlighting health risks with more detection of PFAS in everyday products and water sources. Clean Water Action's Lynn Thorpe says they welcome the move, but stress it also serves as a wake-up call to manufacturers of these chemicals.
If we have to take this action and restrict them in drinking water, then we need to take equally aggressive action to keep the chemicals from getting into the water and the environment in the first place.
There is some concern from operators of public water systems who are fretting about costs to update facilities. However, officials note there's federal funding to help with the transition. Last year, Wisconsin adopted its own PFAS standards for drinking water, but the new federal rule is tougher, and state officials say they're taking steps to adopt them. Democratic Governor Tony Evers and the Republican-led legislature have been at odds over how to handle state funding to address PFAS. Meanwhile, some advocates feel the new federal standard is long overdue. But Thorpe says given the heightened awareness over the past couple of years, the latest action shows policymakers are taking this seriously.
I will say that the process has moved relatively rapidly, and I think that's a reflection of the seriousness of the problem.
Under the new rule, the EPA estimates between 6 and 10% of 66,000 public drinking water systems around the U.S. may have to take action to reduce PFAS. All of them have 3 years to complete initial monitoring, and if levels exceed the new standards, these systems must take corrective action within 5 years. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The time right now is 6:19 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news right here on WORT.
This summer, a statue honoring Vel Phillips will be installed on the grounds of the state capitol. Grounds officials approved the installation on Friday after nearly 4 years of talks and private fundraising. The statue will be the first commemoration of a Black leader at the People's House. Michael Johnson, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, spearheaded the project. Earlier today, he told our news producer Faye Parks that student protests in 2020 inspired him to act.
In 1951, Vel Phillips became the first Black woman to graduate from UW-Madison's law school. She went on to be the first Black woman elected to the Democratic National Committee and the first woman and Black person to be elected to a statewide office when she became the Secretary of State in 1978. These are just some of her many accomplishments over the course of her career. And she'll break another glass ceiling in June, becoming the first Black leader to get a statue on state capitol grounds. On the phone, we have Michael Johnson, President and CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, to give us the rundown.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So to start, can you give us some background? What inspired you to advocate for a new statue on Capitol grounds?
When the George Floyd incident happened in Minneapolis, there was a group of students at the state capitol that was concerned that there was no representation of people of color at the state capitol. Once I found out that that was happening, I reached out to the governor's office, and they had confirmed that there was no representation of people of color. And then the governor had shared with me there was a picture of Bill Phillips in his office. I then started meeting with leaders from across the state and put together a committee of folks who could recommend prospective people that we would nominate to build a statue. There were some people telling me that it would not happen because at the time, the state group that manages the facilities outside had a policy in place that there would be no more statues placed outside of the Capitol grounds. When I learned that, I wrote a letter to the governor and to the chairman of what they call the SCIRD board, and had a series of meetings with the governor's office, the speaker's office, and members of the committee. And it was really the idea of those young activists who encouraged me to do something about making sure that there was representation at our state capitol.
Was Bell Phillips the first person you thought of, or did you consider commemorating other Black leaders in the state's history before selecting her?
Yeah, there were some other names of some, I can't remember all the names, but there was somebody from Green Bay, somebody in Milwaukee. There was a couple of names that came up in Madison. And I think we thought, well, who would be the person that had like statewide recognition? And so when I had met Bill Phillips once, when they named a student hall after her at UW, and that was the first time I learned her background. So I didn't need to be sold on her. I already knew her history and knew because of her statue in Wisconsin that she would get, I believe, that she would get bipartisan support, and she did.
So it sounds like you didn't get much pushback from state lawmakers, but did you get any pushback from Capitol grounds officials regarding that rule about no new statues?
Yeah, early on, it was amazing. I had met with the governor's office. They were excited about it, and I met with Speaker's Vault's office, and they pretty much did not do anything to block it. And then at the time, there was a representative, I think her name was Laubach, who was the Republican chair of the committee. She was very, very supportive. And then I think the concern was them changing that policy, I think, was probably our biggest hurdle. And then once we got past that hurdle, I knew that we got past that hurdle that we would figure out how to raise the money. We didn't want to ask the state or ask the taxpayers to pay for it. And so I knew that if we raised the money privately, that we would be good to go.
And so you mentioned the private funding. What did that fundraising look like? And what were some of the big supporters?
It was amazing. You know, I think I posted it on social media, then we created a website. I think within a week, we raised $100,000. And then one day, I got a text message from somebody out of Milwaukee that contributed $50,000. And then a lot of the foundations, the Mass Community Foundation, the Rennenbaum Foundation, between the two of them, they gave $100,000. And then we met with the Milwaukee Brewers and the Milwaukee Bucks, and, you know, they gave money. And then I think close to 2,000 people gave anywhere from, you know, a kid that was selling lemonade to somebody who made us their largest personal gift of $53,000. So it was really all across the board from all over the state. We originally thought the statue was going to be a $200,000 project, and ended up turning into a $500,000 project. What's also special about this, the Radcliffe Bailey, who has since passed on, is a well-known sculptor. And he designed the statue for us. We hired him to be able to do that work. And when he passed away, he had a brain aneurysm, right? When he had about 90% of the work done. So his team was able to, you know, finish the work. And it's being produced at a studio in Philadelphia, where they just elected their first African-American mayor, I believe, in 125 years. We're talking to the mayor's office there to look at a way to have some sort of press event where they send the statue off from Philadelphia on to the state capitol grounds. And then we're thinking sometime in June, we'll have some sort of ceremony with, you know, elected officials, community leaders, Bill Phillips family, and we'll unveil the statue and then talk about how we're going to continue her legacy. She will become the first woman in the United States to have a singular statue outside of state capitol grounds. There's Rosa Parks that's at the Washington, D.C. monument there, but that's the federal capitol. And then there's a statue of some women, I think, in Virginia, that's of a group of women slaves, but she will be the first singular statue of a woman on Capitol grounds.
And so I'm curious, too, what kind of feedback has this project gotten from the public? You mentioned there was a lot of grassroots organizing to raise that funding. But what have you heard, especially from the students who were pushing for more representation at the state capitol?
I think people are very pleased to see that this happening. I've got nothing. I'm used to fighting for everything. This is probably the first big project I've taken on where there's been no opposition. And it's unusual. And so I was prepared for somebody to walk in on that vote and oppose, so have some reason to oppose it. And so the opposition never came. But I think because of how respected she is in the state of Wisconsin and people know about her history, and I think this is going to open the door for other groups that represent Wisconsin. She'll be the first Black woman. But I hope that there's a Latino, a Native American, and that there's other representation at our state capitol in some way, right, that reflect the fabric of what our state is made of.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, I would ask people, you know, if they can Google our website and donate to Vail Phillips, even though we've raised enough money to build a statue, we're now going to be raising money for an endowment. So when students go and click that QR code that's going to be on the statue and they want to learn more about Vail Phillips, how the statue was created, why it was created, that there'll be some resources available that align with what Vail Phillips stood for. So we're going to be creating a legacy endowment that we hope will generate enough revenue to be able to support issues that she cared about moving forward. So we would ask people if they would consider still making contributions.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Michael.
All right. Thanks so much and good luck with the story.
That was Michael Johnson, president and CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, on the new statue of Vail Phillips headed to state capitol grounds this summer.
You are listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of our show. We talk with a local award-nominated Zine editor. We commemorate the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. We take a closer look at a popular cocktail, and we review two dystopian movies.
But now we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
Please join us on Monday, April 15 at 7 p.m. for a very special Access Hours. We are proud to present
Turning Points.
Students' Voice Forum is high school.
We are a diverse student body with hopes and dreams.
We come from across the globe.
We are your neighbors.
We are your friends.
We are your children.
We are here with you and we invite you to hear our story.
That's Monday, April 15th from 7 to 8 p.m. on the Access Hour.
No, no, means, but no.
BBC News with Stuart McIntosh. Donald Trump has marked the end of the first day of a landmark criminal trial against him in New York by telling reporters it's a political witch hunt. He denies trying to disguise a hush money payment to an adult film star in 2016. Police in Australia say the knife attack at a church in West Sydney on Monday was a terrorist incident. A 15-year-old boy was arrested after a bishop and several other people were stabbed during a sermon. Israel's war cabinet has met for a second time in as many days to discuss how to respond to Iran's unprecedented drone and missile attack. Nearly all of the more than 300 missiles and drones fired towards Israel were shot down. The White House has described Iran's attack as a spectacular and embarrassing failure. The head of the UN's nuclear agency says the Zaporizhzhia power station in Ukraine is on the verge of a serious accident. Drones attacked the building containing the nuclear reactor on Sunday. The lower house of parliament in Britain has rejected six amendments to a controversial new bill which aims to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda. They included an amendment that would have prevented the removal of people who'd supported the UK's armed forces overseas. Creating fake sexually explicit material of someone without their consent is set to become a criminal offence in parts of Britain. The new law is a response to a significant rise in such content online, which predominantly targets women and celebrities. The weapons supervisor who loaded the gun that killed a cinematographer on the set of the film Rust has been sentenced to 18 months in prison. Hannah Gutierrez Reed was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in March. The actor Alec Baldwin was holding the weapon when it fired during rehearsals in New Mexico in 2021. BBC News.
...6:33 your time right now, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. We appreciate you joining us tonight.
The Hugo Awards are among the most prestigious in genre writing, and this year, one Madison-based sci-fi zine is a nominee. The zine is called Giga Notosaurus, and it's edited by LaShawn Wanick, who last week caught up with Friday 8 o'clock Buzz host Andy Moore. Wanick tells us how she got started in the sci-fi genre, what she looks for in writers who want to publish in Giganotosaurus, and shared an original poem. But she starts off by telling us how she found out about the Hugo Award nomination.
A big congratulations to you. What a big deal. How did you find out about the nomination?
They notified us 2 weeks before the big announcement, and they've actually sent me an email, and I hadn't actually checked my email for the magazine because I was busy doing other things. So they actually had to reach me on LinkedIn to say, hey, we sent you an email. And I woke up on Saturday morning with this LinkedIn message and I was like, oh, I better check and see. And went and checked my email and there it was, the announcement that we've been nominated, and it utterly floored me. I was like, holy cow.
What a thing to wake up to.
Yeah.
It's one thing, you know, if you checked your email in the middle of the day, but here you are fisting your eyes open and there it was. And it you say it just floored you?
It did, yeah. I was not expecting that because we're a very small magazine. We only put out one short story a month between 5,000 and 25,000 words. So yeah,
that's even more remarkable. That's even more remarkable. That the format should be honored in that way with a nomination. I want to ask you more specifically about Giganotosaurus. Sean, I noticed the word speculative is used to label this kind of literature. What does that term mean to you?
Yes, we say science fiction, but obviously there's a lot more. The genre is more widespread. When I do writing, I write science fiction, but I find myself a lot more drawn to fantasy. Speculative is basically inclusive of that. So it's anything that goes beyond the real world. Magic realism would fall in that category. Mm-hmm. Horror would fall in that category, things of that nature. It's more of a, and basically stories that don't fit in either genre. So my stories tend to sometimes slide between science fiction and fantasy because I just like being in that space where anything is possible. It doesn't have to be strictly science fiction or fantasy. So
as I was preparing for this segment, I bumped into that word speculative the first time and it kind of put me off. And I thought about it a little further. And then it made all the sense in the world to me, since when I think of the word speculative in my mind, it means along the lines of yet to be determined or proved. And that's sort of in the wheelhouse of sci-fi, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It makes you think.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
And that's the whole purpose. And that's why I love the genre so much, because stories like that make you think and ponder and make you consider possibilities that you normally don't think of. And that's what I strive for when I read stories for Giganotosaurus. Mm. Stories that are really, they stimulate your brain and help you ponder deep questions, but also do it in a way that's literary and that calls attention to beautiful language and things of that nature.
Let's continue down that lane. What, in more specific terms, do you look for as the editor for in a submitted story? What are the ingredients that you're hoping will make the recipe for a story that worthy of a Giganotosaurus?
That is a very good question, because I've been trying to figure that out myself. It's like, what draws me to, saying, okay, this story will be published? And it could be a number of things. I usually say it's stories that surprise me or catch me off guard, stories that do have a deep meaning. I will say that my Christian faith does cause me to go out and, I'm really drawn to stories about faith in general. Mm-hmm. So especially stories about people wrestling with faith, people losing faith, people finding faith, faith changing to something else. And of course, that also goes, my stories also tend to have a slight feminist bent because, I love stories about empowered women and things like that. I also am striving to use the magazine as a way for queer authors and trans authors to able to tell their stories. So I eagerly seek those out. But then stories that just are just good, which I know that's very, very subjective.
I don't feel like we've done justice to sort of the history of Giganotosaurus. Could you give us a little 30-second synopsis on that?
Yeah. Giganotosaurus was founded in 2011 by Anne Leckie. And Anne Leckie, by her own right, is an amazing author. I highly, highly recommend people picking up her books. She actually is on this year's ballot, believe it or not, for the Hugos. She's also been nominated for Best Novel and Best Series.
Oh, my.
Imagine our surprise.
Right.
That was actually the second great surprise, when we found out that we were on the same ballot. For her, it's like things have come full circle.
Oh, my.
So she was very, very excited to see us on the same ballot.
Do you plan to go to Glasgow in August for the Hugo Award presentations?
Yes, I do.
Oh, yay.
I will.
Good.
I'll be going. Oh, it's going to be crazy.
Maybe we'll be able to have you back and hear about what it was like. If you'd be so kind, in the minute or so we have left, would you set up and share one of your poems? And I know poetry is something that's not exactly on your focus anymore, because once you got that pay grade raised to editor, you've got other fish to fry. But if you could set up the poem and read it to us, would you please do that now?
Yeah. I mean, I still write, short stories and all that. But yeah, on occasion, I do write poetry. And with this one, I wrote this one. It's called The Last Walk Home. The offices that I worked at, I used to work at a nonprofit. We moved to a bigger building, but the old building was closer to my house so I could walk home every day, which was great, you know, for raising, you know, my son. We got to walk him to school and then walk him to work. And so the new building was a little further for us. So, yeah. And then there were other stuff that was happening, too, that was sort of some hard things. But this instance happened that was absolutely real. And once I got home, I wrote a poem about it. So the last walk home, after I pack up my cubicle and tell the movers where our stuff is, I decide to walk home because it's the last time I can do so. Halfway there, I reach the corner where a mother and her two girls are waiting for the bus. The younger girl, with beads in her hair, looks up to me. "I like your shirt." And then, shyly, she touches a finger to my side as if proving to herself I was real. A minivan pulls up in front of us. The driver sticks her head out. "Hey, y'all, how y'all doing?" The older girl replies, "I know you. What's your name?" The woman says, "My name is Tweety Bird." Then, "I have two working teenagers," as she drives off, leaving us behind in the lingering smell of lilac, beneath the harsher scent of rain-soaked pavement, a reminder that the world continues in chaotic flux. And moments such as this can be stronger than grief.
Oh, LaShawn, Monica, thank you so much for sharing that and for joining us on the Friday Buzz.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
That was LaShawn Wanick, editor of the sci-fi zine Giganotosaurus. The zine was just nominated for the genre's highest honor, the Hugo. Find the full interview online at wartfm.org.
This Saturday, April 20th, is the 14th anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion and spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It was the world's largest offshore oil spill and the worst environmental disaster in the U.S. history. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has that story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. For the Union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
This Saturday, April 20th, is the anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion and fire in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 workers were missing, presumed dead, with 17 injured. The explosion and fire caused the largest offshore oil spill in the world and the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history. As much as 100 million barrels of oil spilled off the coast of Louisiana. The accident happened shortly before 10 p.m. on a Saturday in 2010. The 11 who died should be remembered first in any story about this catastrophe. Jason Anderson, 35, tool pusher of Midland, Texas. He left behind his spouse, Shelley, and two children. Del Burkane, 37, crane operator from outside Philadelphia, Mississippi. He left behind his spouse, Rhonda, and two children. Donald Clark, 49, assistant driller of Newlton, Louisiana. He left behind his spouse, Sheila, and four children. Stephen Curtis, 40, assistant driller of Georgetown, Louisiana. He left behind his spouse, Nancy, and two children. Gordon Jones, 28, mud engineer of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He left behind his pregnant spouse, Michelle, and a son. Michelle gave birth to a son 24 days after the blowout. Roy Wyatt Kemp, 27, derrick man, recently promoted to assistant driller of Jonesville, Louisiana. He left behind his spouse, Courtney, and two daughters. Carl Kleppinger, 38, floor hand of Natchez, Mississippi. He left behind his spouse, Tracy, and a son. Blair Manuel, 56, mud engineer of St. Amant, Louisiana. He left behind his fiancée, Melinda, and three daughters. Dewey Revett, 48, driller of State Line, Mississippi. He left behind his spouse, Natalie, and one child. Adam Weiss, 24, floorhand of Yorktown, Texas. The independent Deepwater Horizon Study Group report published in March of 2010 suggested the root cause was British Petroleum's, BP's, laissez-faire attitude towards safety. The report, compiled by 64 experienced professionals, experts, and scholars, gave a damning report of BP's failures. From the report, support, safety was compromised to the point the blowout occurred with catastrophic results. Other reports say BP knew about the fault in the blowout preventer, the piece of equipment that ultimately failed, triggering an explosion, but did nothing to fix it. In addition, BP's contingency plan for dealing with a catastrophic oil spill contained many flaws, stated a report by the Associated Press. BP was accused of lying to Congress by Congressman Ed Markey, then the House Subcommittee on Energy and Environment head, after a leaked internal document showed BP's own worst-case assessment of the oil leak was 20 times its public estimate. Markey said, "The document raises very troubling questions about what BP knew and when they knew it. It is clear from the beginning that BP has not been straightforward with the government or the American people about the true size of the spill." Critically, 10 years later, the members of the Bipartisan National Commission set up to find the cause of the disaster and prevent a repeat said many of their recommendations were never taken seriously as drilling moves farther offshore and deeper underwater, they said. Another spill of equally disastrous proportions is possible. Even the Republican co-chair, William K. Riley, EPA head under the first President Bush, said, "No, I don't think we're prepared for another spill of that magnitude." The Center for Biological Diversity found that the spill likely harmed or killed 82,000 birds of 102 species, about 6,165 sea turtles, as many as 25,900 marine mammals, and a vast but unknown number of fish, from the great bluefin tuna to our nation's smallest seahorse, plus oysters, crabs, corals, and other creatures. On January 27, 2014, 300 people in Cure Beach, North Carolina, showed up to object to Atlantic oil drilling, setting off a movement that has spread to 400 municipalities and over 2,300 elected local, state, and federal officials. They have officially opposed oil and gas drilling. Nearly every governor along the East and West Coast, Republicans and Democrat alike, have expressed concerns with and/or opposition to expanded oil and gas exploration, development, and production off their coasts. Along the Atlantic coast, numerous fishing and tourism interests and an alliance representing over 59,000 businesses and 500,000 fishing families from Florida to Maine also strongly oppose oil development off the East Coast. Tragically, this has had little effect on U.S. Presidents Obama, Trump, or Biden, who each continued policies of offshore oil drilling and oil fields in environmentally sensitive areas. Biden has supported 3 additional Gulf wells and approved drilling on federal lands in northern Arctic Alaska with the Willow Project, despite election promises to do no more drilling on federal lands, period. And that is our story for today. For the past in the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's now 6:47 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Today on Madison Mixology, host Charlie Bielowski tells us how to make a Long Island iced tea, a cocktail with over 5 different types of alcohol and connections to Prohibition.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite reporter, Charlie Bielowski. Today, I have a well-known drink with a lot of ingredients and a ton of alcohol. Get prepared, because today I'm teaching you guys how to make the Long Island iced tea. The Long Island iced tea has a history with a hotly debated beginning and 3 apparent conceptions at different points in time. The earliest suggested origin story takes us all the way back to Prohibition. A community called Long Island in Kingsport, Tennessee, tells of a man named Old Man Bishop who originally created what he called the Long Island iced tea using ingredients like whiskey, maple syrup, and 5 other spirits. The concoction was improved upon by his son Ransom Bishop when he added cola, lemon, and lime juice. The second theory suggests that a bartender named Robert Rosebud Butt, and I'm not kidding when I say that, the guy's last name was actually Butt, invented the Long Island iced tea in 1972 as an entry to a contest to create a new mixed drink with triple sec. As the name suggests, Rosebud Butt worked at the Oak Beach Inn in Long Island, New York. The drink was thus named after the city. Lastly, it is speculated that it was one of the many drinks to be born out of TGI Fridays in the mid-1970s. Nobody for sure knows the exact origin of the beverage, but due to drinks of similar nature being popularized in the 20s to disguise booze, one would speculate that it came about earlier rather than later. The drink is commonly criticized due to its high amount of ingredients and numerous different alcohols, and is polarizing to bartenders due to the time it takes to make such a beverage and the refreshing and bright taste of the finished product. Despite this, the International Bartenders Association recognizes it today as an official drink. According to the IBA, to make a proper Long Island iced tea, we will need to put together the following liquors into a highball glass, starting with our glass and ice, of course. From there, we add a half ounce of tequila. Then we add some vodka, a half ounce again, a half ounce of white rum, a half ounce of Contro, and a half ounce of gin. Once that's mixed in, we add an ounce of lemon juice, a half ounce of simple syrup, and top it off the rest of the way with cola. After giving it a gentle stir, it's time to give it a try. The Long Island iced tea is deceptively easy to drink. It's very sweet, and that sweetness masks a lot of the alcohol flavor that's in there. I would credit that to the simple syrup that's added in there. And despite the really like kind of deceptively sweet taste, it hits very hard. The blend works really well, and it's very refreshing. Only maybe one of these drinks, and you'll definitely start feeling it. It's usually put in a higher glass, and the alcohol content is absolutely insane when it comes down to it. The Long Island iced tea works because, you know, it gets the job done. It's got a massive amount of liquor when compared to its mixers, and it's guaranteed to loosen you up in at least one glass. As expected from such a popular drink, imitations and changes were bound to follow. For example, the Grateful Dead is a version of the Long Island iced tea, but it uses raspberry liqueur in place of the Contro and lemon-lime soda instead of cola. From there, if you swap out the raspberry liqueur for Midori, you can actually get the Tokyo iced tea, and it has a pleasant green hue to it. Beware when trying this mix. It goes down easy, and it bites you when you least expect it. Take care, and I'll be back next week with another new beverage on Madison Mixology. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Charlie Bielowski.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews two dystopian movies. Mortal Engines came out in 2018, but just started streaming on Netflix. And Harry says it's an okay, if derivative, movie with good visuals. And Civil War started showing in theaters this weekend. Harry says it is violent, gripping, and imagines an all-too-plausible future for the United States.
Nothing can stand in the face of this.
We have to stop London before it destroys us.
That was a clip from the trailer for Mortal Engines, directed by Christian Rivers. More famous are its co-writers, Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens, and Peter Jackson. Walsh and Jackson are producers as well. The movie is based on a novel series of the same name by Philip Reeve. I read the first book and found it to be a fun, quick read. The movie came out in 2018 and recently started playing on Netflix. The movie, despite a talented cast, is just okay. It received a 26% on Rotten Tomatoes by critics and only 48% from the audience. Rivers is Jackson's longtime storyboard and special effects artist, and it shows. The movie looks cool, and special effects are convincing, and some action scenes work really well, but somehow the story doesn't really amount to much. The main problem is that it's just so derivative of other better movies. Our story takes place in a post-apocalyptic Europe 200 years after the 60-minute war that destroyed civilization and most of the people. What remains are giant mobile cities on wheels roaming over a barren landscape. It's a time of municipal Darwinism, explains our main bad guy, the power-hungry, ultimate weapon maker, Thaddeus Valentine. Hugo Weaving. He's a popular leader of London, which is the principal traction city, chasing and devouring smaller traction cities in order to use their resources and collect their old tech. Valentine is on the hunt for ancient pieces of the ultimate weapon. Inadvertently aiding him in his quest is junior historian Tom Nasworthy, Robert Sheehan. Tom meets Valentine through Valentine's daughter, a fellow junior historian, Catherine Lila George. Tom calls out as a mysterious masked woman, Hester Shaw, Hera Hilmar, stabs Valentine. Tom struggles with the woman and gives chase as she flees to escape the city. Valentine is in pursuit as well. Hester drops down a giant chasm, jerking away from Tom's grasp. Valentine is close behind and fears Tom has learned too much, so he pushes the shocked Tom down the same seemingly deep, deadly pit. Tom and Hester somehow survive the fall and end up forming an uneasy alliance to survive. There's more, but you get the idea. All in all, a fairly fun movie, if too derivative and predictable. Up next, another movie about our future that unfortunately feels fairly plausible.
19 states have seceded.
The United States Army ramps up activity.
The White House issued warnings to the Western forces as well as the Florida Alliance.
The three-term president assures the uprising will be dealt with swiftly.
And that was clipped from the trailer for the gripping, violent, relentless Civil War, directed by Alex Garland. It's not about the 1860s Civil War, but one that many fear could take place in our near future. As our movie opens in a eerily depopulated New York, desperate people are in line for rationed water. Photojournalist Lee, a great Kristen Durst, is a weary war correspondent, this time at home, not covering some far-off conflict. She weaves through the crowd, instinctively going for the best shot, with finely honed reflexes to take cover quickly. She's followed by her friend, fellow reporter Joel Wagner Mora. Then a bomb goes off, and they literally bump into newbie, would-be photojournalist Jesse Kaylee Spaney. They meet again that evening at a hotel. Lee and Joel are having a casual drink or two with veteran journalist Sammy Stephen McKinley Henderson. Sammy has somehow retained his warmth and humanity amidst every familiar thing falling apart. He works for what he calls the competition, and for what the other two regard as what's left of the New York Times. Joel and Lee have hatched a risky plan to travel to Washington, D.C. for one last interview with the president, well played by Nick Offerman. The war is not going well for the national government. Details are few and scattered throughout the story. The Western Coalition, led by an unlikely combination of Texas and California, is on the offensive. Sammy pleads for a ride to the front, which happens to be on their way. Meanwhile, Jesse talks with Lee, thanking her for her help, and says how much she admires her work. Jesse, exhausted, walks up 10 flights of stairs. She's been warned by the front desk people about the possible power shortages on the elevator. She unwinds in the tub, closing her eyes, but she just sees horrors of past days. The next morning, Joel gives Lee the bad news. He's decided to let Sammy tag along, but just to the front, not D.C. Lee had let it up to him to decide. Worse still, he's agreed to take on the newbie, Jesse. The ensuing road trip forms the balance of our story, showing the cruelty and arbitrary nature of war. There is no happy ending. A well-done film, well worth seeing. It just started playing at local theaters. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Special thanks to feature contributors Harry Richardson and Charlie Bielowski. And thanks to the Buzz host Andy Moore, Wisconsin News Connections' Mike Moen, Nicholas Leet for technical production, and Bill Kingsbury for web production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial. It's called The Access Hour. Have a good night.
listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Good evening, and thank you for listening to tonight's Access Hour, Turning Points, Student Voices from Madison's East High School. My name is Mark Appel, and I'm a teacher here at East in the multilingual and history departments. The stories you'll hear tonight come from our students. They talk about their immigration experiences, their lives here in Madison, being a teenager, their stories of family and friends, of school. Hope you enjoy all of them. These amazing students hail from as far away as the DRC, Mexico, Honduras, Nicaragua, Afghanistan, Puerto Rico, Mali, Senegal, Gambia, Guinea. We have the pleasure of hearing stories from their lives tonight. If at any point you don't understand the story, it might be because they're still learning English. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Turning Points, Student Voices from Madison East High School.
Hey, my name is Sandra. I want to talk about when my first day when we're coming in America. I was with my family and other people too. We came from Uganda and other people from Burundi. We are so happy to be here in USA.